opinion, if betting wasn't against the law, though, I'd give you great odds.
Well, I bought 3 lottery tickets and I didn't win anything, so I'm not I'm not taking this lightly.
No, no, I understand. Obviously, having this declared unconstitutional is not a good idea.
That's right.
I don't see it as the problem that you do because it is a two-step process. It's that first conviction is not the occasion for the forfeiture. It's the driving after that conviction that's the occasion. That does not result in a conviction because there isn't any criminal proceedings at all.
Thank you, Representative Edmondson. I just have one interjection here that might add to the discussion. In aggravated crimes, we sometimes say, I think, that if you do this crime plus this stuff over here, that that equals a new crime. Is the analysis similar? I mean, I remember some of those crimes having been challenged before, I think, as double jeopardy. Maybe that's not the
gun
challenge.
Gun minimums and things like that is what
right,
you're referring
right.
to.
Is there some similarities here?
Only in the widest sense.
Okay.
I think
in other words, no.
The bottom line is that we got 2 separate incidents, both of which had to happen. One of the earlier one was a conviction. This one is not.
If this were found considered to be in the constitutional sense forfeiture a conviction, then this law would change.
If this, in a constitutional sense, the finding that you were in violation was a conviction, and that the forfeiture resulted from the conviction, and that that's how they would interpret that constitutional provision, then this law would not stand.
Chair?
Yeah.
I don't want silence to be read to be consent here. Corruption of blood refers to the old concept that all of your heirs lost all their rights when you were convicted of a crime. And forfeiture of estate is an old term of art, as I understand it, that says that basically that when you're convicted, you don't lose all of your estates, all of your lands, all of your property, and without any connection to the commission of the crime. I don't believe it has ever been read to mean that you can't forfeit the instrumentality of that crime or the instrumentality of your acts, which is exactly why we have this other
2282
here, which has to do with civil forfeiture. We have to show a nexus between the property and the activity which is condemned. And if there's a nexus, and there may be some argument at some point that there's no nexus between driving while suspended and the motor vehicle, but I think there obviously is. And I don't want to go unchallenged necessarily that there is an unconstitutionality problem here. Others may be able to develop the argument differently upon due research, but I want to be real careful about that old phraseology.
Let me just comment on my concern. We have all done thorough and frustrating analyses of Brown v. Multnomah County. And I am a little bit concerned that what we start to embark on here is that same kind of domino effect of, you know, the condition precedent is, and coincidentally enough, it happens to be a DUII, which certainly starts to look familiar when you look back at the underlying facts of Brown v. Multnomah County. So that's an issue that the committee needs to deal with. Let me ask you a couple of questions, because I think the purpose here is agreed upon. And my concern, I mean, Representative Kalori has nurtured a purpose. This subcommittee is nurturing a purpose. They are not in opposition. In fact, they're very similar. It seems to me that the object here, Judge Keyes, is quite clear. The first object is we want to have a mechanism to forfeit cars. One of the conditions for achieving this object in a way that's sufficient and keeps us from running even more afoul of the possible difficulty of Brown v. Multnomah County is to decriminalize the underlying offense and make this process be what happens to you if you engage in this activity when your license is suspended. Okay, as long as we're tracking so far. At our last work session on 2282, we defeated a motion to specifically include driving while suspended within the realm of 2282. We heard testimony on another amendment which also failed, which I have subsequently discussed with the Attorney General's office, and the Attorney General has a representative here today. And part of that discussion had to do with the fact that some forfeitures reap profits to the agency and some forfeitures don't. And every agency sees both kinds. I'm wondering if we can put together a compromise package, and I want to raise this possibility, and then I want to recess the committee, because I think we need to. We have a couple of other amendments that we hear, and you've certainly given us a lot of food for thought. I am not going to repeat history, which in the forfeiture arena says that everyone agrees on the purpose. In a generic kind of a way, everybody wants it, and what happens is we fall apart on the details, and we tried and failed last session to pass a uniform statewide forfeiture law. If anything, we have more reason this session to succeed in an incremental foothold in the forfeiture area. Will it satisfy your purpose, at least incrementally, if we specifically include driving while suspended as an offense which can result in forfeiture? If we move on another front, Judge Keyes, we did hear testimony which raised your support earlier on in the Crime and Corrections Subcommittee on a bill that would have decriminalized driving while suspended, and I think it got stuck in the process because there has not been an outrageous flow of support to reduce the business that you see in your courtroom. Got to tell you the bad news here. But if we can decriminalize some portion of driving while suspended, make driving while suspended clearly a part of what we're contemplating in forfeiture, and then add to the charge of the Oversight Committee, which we have amended into 2282, the charge that they figure out the way to do this, are we going to have succeeded in taking a step in the right direction here? Because I got a bad feeling right now.
First of all, let me say that I'm not sure that the best of all possible worlds is to combine these two bills. Okay? It's certainly a method, but I'm not sure it's the best method. Unless you start off with the assumption that the same procedures should apply to both, which I don't most strongly. I'd rather see no sub-10 amendments than have them try to use 2282 procedures for driving while suspended cases. I'd rather see nothing than that. I think it will cost the state of Oregon a ton of money. Okay?
Could you say that again, Judge? I'm sorry.
I would rather not have this at all than try to decriminalize and use 2282 procedures to accomplish /10 purposes. I'd rather see nothing than that, because I think it's going to cost an incredible amount of money to try to do it that way. Now, that doesn't mean I don't want the /10 language. I really don't think we have any business trying to do it with 2282 procedures. Now, whether we do it in two bills, one bill, conceptually, whatever. We all know we're running into time problems here as far as getting legislation through. I'm going to leave it in your more capable hands as to the procedures, but the only thing I do know is whether you separate this from 2282, keep it together, or the way you accomplish what you are talking about accomplishing is up to you. The only thing I don't think we should do is try to handle /10 problems with 2282 procedures. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, it does. It sounds a little bit like you would rather have nothing than something.
I'd rather not try to get us into a situation where we decriminalize and then try to process even 4,000 cars under 2282 procedure. You're correct. I think it'll cost too much money. I honestly do.
Madam Chair.
Representative Maddox.
There is not a necessary connection between decriminalization and using the standard 2282 forfeiture proceedings to forfeit a motor vehicle.
No, what that will mean is if you drive a Mercedes when you're suspended, you get it, you lose it, but if you drive a 57 Plymouth, you won't. And I guess that's okay.
I think, Judge Keyes, let me suggest to you that that's not necessarily the way enforcement is going to behave, and I'm concerned about the implication of your comments to the entire 2282 structure, because there is the other side here, which is the American Civil Liberties Union, which is quite unhappy at the idea that this is bounty hunting, and that we're going to send police out to capture only the most fruitful drug deals and leave the little bitty neighborhood drug dealer who only sells to K through 6
yes.
in business on the street. I mean, it's popsicles or, you know, the warehouse. Now, I think what we're going to hear, and I want to say, and I already said this once, is that there are type A forfeitures and type B forfeitures. Type A forfeitures, you get lots of stuff for not a whole lot of effort. Type B, and the state would love to come in and skim off 25%, thank you very much, and clean up methamphetamine labs with that. We've had our hands slapped for even looking at that because of the other type of forfeiture, which is the 1957 whatever it is car, which the fruits of the Mercedes forfeiture theoretically, and now I'm talking about the fruits of the cocaine bust, will pay for the meth lab bust. We've been promised this by other law enforcement agencies, and believe me, there is a reason for the compromise and for the working group having gotten together and formed this compromise, because this is tenuous. And if all we're going to do here is send law enforcement out to take care of the big stuff and put money into their coffers and buy good crime equipment, I'm concerned about the whole
package. I wasn't trying to talk about 2282 procedures. I don't claim to be an expert in it. I don't want to be quoted on it in any real sense. But what I can tell you is that there is going to be some judgment used, no matter how you say it, on 2282 procedures. There has to be some judgment used. This bill allows for no judgment because we've decriminalized. What I'm really saying is we have two different purposes, and as a result, I truly believe need two different procedures. And if you're saying, do I think that I am very nervous about the cost to the state if we tried to process all the DWSs under 2282 procedure, I am.
Madam Chair. My observation would be that a very efficient prosecutor reading over this bill could work with staff in a week or two and come up with a neat set of forms, and I could see forfeitures being cranked out very efficiently, very quickly, and probably a volume business in some communities, but the message, if they want to deliver a prosecutor's message to the community about driving while suspended, the message would be heard very quickly. And in terms of efficiency, you'd have to have good forms and good procedures, but that's almost true of any of these enforcement mechanisms. I mean, we've been living with this, Judge, for quite a while. And I've been real open to the idea of coming up with a forfeiture proposal for driving while suspended, but the more I've listened this afternoon, the more I've come around to the idea of maybe we do need a simple approach and try it for 2 years to see if we can use it. And I'm one of the people who, I can't remember where I came down before on driving while suspended as far as forfeiture goes, but I've become convinced that we need to have some provision to yank these motor vehicles from these people. And by the way, for the person who has to rely on a 57, we'll say Studebaker or DeSoto or whatever, proportionately, that is probably just as tough a sanction to take their vehicle as it is for the person who can afford a Mercedes.
Sure.
Maybe
it's
harder.
Absolutely. I was not talking about the effect on the person suffering the loss. I was talking on the economic effect of storage costs versus the cost of the vehicle.
Thank you.
I'm ready to take a brief recess after your question, Representative.
I just have one. The chair asked a question. You answered it. and I'm not sure that I got the answer exactly right. It had to do with the frequency, the scope of the problem, DWS, when dash 10 would apply. Did I hear you say 1,000 times per month?
4,000 cars a year statewide. That's what DMV tells me.
That would fit the definition of having had a prior conviction for DUI and a subsequent conviction for DWS.
Great. We will be in recess. I'd like you to stick around. The committee will be in recess until 10 minutes to 4. Thank you. Here, the subsequent testimony is to consider the possibility that the chair would be willing to work with the speaker's office to obtain a separate hearing. I'm really quite concerned the implication of adding two layers of procedure into one bill. I think it becomes clearer if we separate dash 10. As we all noticed from Judge Key's testimony, it's hard to keep them separate. It's easy to keep them separate. It was hard for him to refer to the concept in the dash 10 as the concept in dash 10. It was 3371 quite consistently. So if we can keep that in mind, and we can hear from, let's take it in order. Pete, could you come up and addressing the DWS issue, which is before us in the dash 10 amendments. I know you had the opportunity to hear Representative Calori and Judge Keyes' testimony, and I'm just curious. I'm actually curious about a couple things. First, I wondered what your response would be to Representative Edmondson's line of questions about the connectedness between a conviction for DUII as the sine qua non for having a vehicle forfeited under the dash 10 construct.
Madam Chair, for the record, Pete Shepard from the Oregon Department of Justice. Let me begin by saying that the Department of Justice has not taken a position on 3371, nor will we take a position today on the dash 10 amendments. I've only skimmed them today, and so I'm in no position to make any comments about those procedures or even compare them in any sensible fashion to those in 2282. I'd be happy to assist the committee in responding to some of the legal questions that were raised by Representative Clark and Representative Edmondson. And I think there are really two questions there, both of which are questions that you asked of me with respect to 2282, and the first is the question regarding the forfeiture of a state provision of the Oregon Constitution, and I think Representative Mannix gave the best argument that we can for why that provision of the Constitution is not implicated by 2282, at least. Madam Chair, that's absolutely correct. The judge was quite correct in saying that he was giving you an estimate of his view of the law, and I'm doing the same.
There's case law out there I think we really need to know about it, and what I'm constantly hearing is there isn't any, and so we may look forward to it.
Representative Edmondson, there are a scattering of cases on similar provisions in other states' constitutions, and they take the approach that Representative Mannix has suggested, linking that language to the historic meaning of those terms. But what you've heard about that provision of the Constitution is quite correct, and we don't have a clear answer to that. I think a related question was raised by Representative Clark and to some extent by your questions as well, and that is the extent to which these any forfeiture provision that purports to be civil may be subject to attack under Brown versus Multnomah County District Court. And that's the case in which the legislature purported to decriminalize driving under the influence of intoxicants and provided a system of administrative sanctions, including some substantial fines. And the basic inquiry that the court conducted there was to look at the record and at the enactment that the legislature had passed and decide whether the legislature's purpose was basically punitive in nature. And the court looked at a host of different factors in making that decision. And one of the questions was whether the legislation served only punitive purposes. And in terms of 2282, we hope to distinguish ourselves from that kind of analysis on four grounds. First, as the judge says, that we're intending to raise some revenue with this measure. Second, that we have the purpose of evening out the procedural landscape from county to county, which now varies because of the existence of local forfeiture ordinances. Third, that we're intending to deter, and that certainly is related to the punitive aspect, but we're intending to deter certain kinds of conduct. And finally, we're addressing activity which is undertaken for profit, that is, the original draft of 2282, narcotics, drugs, gambling, and prostitution. But now the bill, as amended, simply addresses narcotics, and the fact that the conduct which is made the subject of the civil penalty is conducted for profit rather than for some other purpose was a relevant consideration in Brown versus Multnomah County District Court. That's really all I have to say about the Dash 10. If there are other legal questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Are there questions, Representative Clark?
Brown versus Multnomah County was in some senses in a proportionality case?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, only by inference, and the inference is that the conclusion of Brown versus Multnomah County was that Mr. Brown was entitled, because this remained a criminal proceeding, he was entitled to the what he asked for, which was a jury trial and court-appointed counsel. Presumably, if Mr. Brown had asked for proportionate punishment because it was still a criminal matter, then he would have been able to prevail in that case because the court concluded it was criminal. But that was not directly before the court.
And why was it criminal in that case? What was the sanction?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, it was criminal because the court concluded that the legislature was really acting with the intent to enhance the penalties for driving under the influence of intoxicants while sidestepping the procedural and substantive protections of the criminal process.
To that extent, then, Dash 10 or 3371, however you want to refer to it, might look a little bit different to the court to the extent that we're specifically saying we're going to decriminalize DWS, which is not present in Brown versus Multnomah County.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, actually the factor of decriminalization was present in Brown versus Multnomah County because the administrative scheme that was attacked there was what the legislature had adopted to replace the criminal sanction attached to driving under the influence of intoxicants. I want to make clear, though, for the committee that I'm not offering an opinion as to whether Brown versus Multnomah County would be a successful attack on 3371 or the Dash 10 amendments.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Other questions?
You got one over there. Under.
Representative Calhoun.
Madam Chair, Representative Calhoun, that's a very difficult question to answer prospectively because of the number of variables involved, including whether we happen on to cases which don't cost us much to investigate, or whether we happen on to a lot of cases, such as some of the cases that the state police have encountered, where they have a couple of hours of investigative time and they discover $153,000 in cash. It's difficult to answer. Historically, the Oregon State Police, as I understand it, fund all 66 of their field narcotics investigators from money that they get through federal forfeiture revenues right now. They're here in the room. They may be able to tell you how much that is. I think it's on the order of $600,000. So I can tell you the answer to that. I can tell you the answer to the question, what did we get in the last 2 years, and that the state police got somewhere around $600,000.
Representative Calhoun.
I think it's $600,000. The other question is, question. How much money are we going to spend in litigation and other collection-related matters to be able to even utilize that?
Madam Chair, Representative Calhoun, again, difficult to project. In some cases, of course, cases that you might characterize as type A cases, cases in which revenues exceed costs, there will be no net outlay of costs for, at least for attorney's fees and that kind of thing, because those are recoverable under the bill from the forfeited asset. In the other category of cases, of which there will be some, type B cases, where the asset is not sufficient to cover costs, there will be some net outlay. And I can't answer the question of how much that's going to be. Madam Chair, Representative Calhoun, that's a question that I don't know the answer to, but that I can answer for you, probably not this afternoon, but I just don't know what, in terms of you're suggesting defending the constitutionality of a bill like this. we can get the answer for that. I think $100,000 is probably too much, but I don't know what it would be.
We're in work session, so...
Before you start making motions, I'd like to hear from some other groups that are represented here.
All right.
Frank Bronner. Thank you, Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Frank Bronner with the Oregon Bankers Association. With me is Ken Sherman, our general counsel. And obviously, since the Dash 10 became available to us. When your hearing started, we've been working in the back of the room, hopefully quietly, discussing what's in the Dash 10. When we started this process, Madam Chair, over a year ago, dealing with forfeiture, and we've already testified to this committee about our concern, our need, our desire that we support a statewide forfeiture statute. We asked that there be timely notice. We asked that the local ordinances that were springing up all over be preempted, leaving local governments the authority to adopt whatever they chose to with regard to prohibited conduct, but leaving one process, hopefully a single process, the less complicated the better, in place for dealing with forfeiture of any kind of property. And finally, we wanted to protect everybody's rights, including security interests. Now, I must tell you that we offered to this committee an amendment to include DWS in House Bill 2282. And you know of the Portland Ordinance and other ordinances that are out there. we have sympathy with Judge Key's concern and frustration, but I do not believe we can support a tax on security interest holders to address that concern. Ken has been able to go through the bill, and I know that you don't want all of his many pages of notes, but we'd like to give you a flavor if we could, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sherman with the Oregon Bankers Association. Just really begun the process of trying to go through and figure out the amendments that have been offered and the interrelationship of those amendments to the larger bill. But we do have some concerns, and I think Frank has already alluded to the primary one, which is the question of whether the admittedly laudable purpose of taking from a person who is bent upon using a vehicle, notwithstanding the suspension under the circumstances described in the bill, whether the cost of that ought to fall upon the financial institution or rather ought to fall on society at large. It seems to me that what this really amounts to is a tax on the individual or the institution that happens to hold a security interest. And Judge Key has alluded several times during his testimony to the fact that that cost would be substantial. I think he said at one point that it would be extraordinary. there is no question that if this state is going to adopt a mandatory forfeiture law that requires the seizure and forfeiture of motor vehicles under the circumstances described here, that there are going to be substantial costs. And we think that it ought to be very carefully considered whether it is appropriate to tax one element or group of society. And we're not just talking about financial institutions. We're talking about people who sell motor vehicles on contracts, and there are a lot of them out there other than financial institutions whose interests and rights need to be taken into consideration. It was also testified to, as I understood it, that this one of the reasons why we ought to do this as a separate procedure rather than just adding driving while suspended as an offense under the larger body of 2282 was that this would be a shorter process, that somehow that we could get through this process in a period of something like 10 to 60 days. And yet, as I read the amendments, and I guess I preface all my comments about the amendments with the thought that I haven't really had a chance to study them, and even if I did, I'm not sure I would fully understand them. But if I read them correctly, we've got a preliminary hearing before the Department of Motor Vehicles, and that is to be followed by a jury trial, if that's the desire of the vehicle owner. And as I understand it, in Multnomah County, they now have, and I guess they're developing in other counties as well,